I think that was A, not B flat. Paul.
Heavy metal ruined my ability to distinguish notes.
Paul DiRienzo is here with the news.
Thank you. Just what do they know? United States military officials hope two senior al-Qaeda fighters will provide important information about Osama bin Laden's terrorist network. The United States captured the fighters this week in eastern Afghanistan and seized their computers and cell phones. Israeli police are bracing for angry protests by Muslims. Israel's security cabinet has decided to halt construction of a mosque next to a major Christian shrine in Nazareth, the town where Jesus grew up. The construction had caused friction between Israel and the Christian world. And a recently fired nuclear plant worker was arrested for allegedly threatening plant employees, and about 150 weapons were found in a shed he rented in his home. That's according to authorities in Los Angeles. The man was fired from his job at the San Onofre nuclear generating station in North San Diego County in recent weeks. The plant, 65 miles south of Los Angeles, is owned by Southern California Edison. Officials served a search warrant on a storage shed in San Juan Capistrano, rented by the man early Wednesday. They found about 150 weapons along with thousands of rounds of ammunition in the storage unit and at his home. Two sheriff's deputies were overcome by fumes at the shed from an unknown chemical. Authorities described the chemical as a yellow vapor from an ammunition canister. The deputies were taken to a hospital to be examined, and a hazardous material team was sent to the site. Russell said a friend of the suspect contacted authorities earlier this week and told them the man had threatened plant employees. The nature of the threats was not immediately released. And the Palestinian Authority is condemning a deadly attack on an Israeli army post near the Gaza Strip. The Israeli military says two Islamic militants armed with grenades and assault rifles stormed the post early today, killing four soldiers before being shot dead in a gun battle. It's the first deadly attack on Israelis in nearly a month and deals a severe blow to U.S. truce efforts. The head judge at the UN War Crimes Tribunal in the Netherlands has again pulled the plug on Slobodan Milosevic. The ousted Yugoslav leader goes on trial next month for alleged atrocities against ethnic Albanians in the province of Kosovo. At a procedural hearing today, he denounced the court, including Chief Judge Richard May of Britain. Milosevic accused the judge of bias. He and May have had a series of such run-ins. Milosevic today said the charges against him are based on British intelligence reports and that the atrocities were committed by NATO and the Albanians. New York Senator Charles Schumer is taking the Federal Aviation Administration to task for backing off a plan to require airport security screeners to have at least a high school education. The senator says that goes against the newly adopted aviation security bill. Yesterday, Schumer was at the Rochester Airport to criticize the FAA plan. A child support caseworker on Long Island who wears a turban as part of his Sikh religion was denied twice from getting on a plane at Long Island's MacArthur Airport. 64-year-old Tejinder Singh Collin says in October he was pulled from a passenger airline and brought to a separate room where security officers wanted him to remove his turban. Kalen says that instead he offered to allow security to feel the headdress or have him walk through a metal detector. Religion experts told Newsday that having a Sikh remove a turban is like asking someone to walk naked in public. Kalen says he's been a U.S. citizen for 25 years and the security stop prevented him from attending a friend's wedding in Arizona. His attorney, Tom Leote, is talking about a multi-million-dollar lawsuit against the town of Islip, which owns the airport, and Southwest Airlines. The potential lawsuit raises questions about the balancing act airport security personnel have to do since the terrorist attacks of September 11th. In New York City, community leaders in Crown Heights vowed that a federal decision granting a new trial to two black men convicted in the 1991 stabbing death of Yankel Rosenbaum won't change their neighborhood. Bensian Meltzer, executive director of the Project Care Community Group, said Crown Heights has gone from beyond the point where the ruling could bring disorder and tension. And Yonkers' 21-year-old school desegregation lawsuit has been tentatively settled. Yonkers will get $300 million over the next 5 years so its school system can comply with the federal desegregation order. The agreement needs to be approved by U.S. District Court Judge Leonard Sand, among others. And finally, the location of the Pacifica Board national meeting has been released. It is going to be held at the DoubleTree Hotel I'll give you the address. It's going to be the Interim Pacific and National Board meeting. It's going to be held in New York City, January 11th through January 13th at the Doubletree Hotel, 1568 Broadway at 47th Street. Again, that's January 11th through January 13th, the Doubletree Hotel, 1368 Broadway at 47th Street. It's my understanding on Friday, January 11th at 6 p.m., there will be a public comment session, a session open to the public, open to listeners, and, of course, Pacifica and WBAI urges all its listeners to attend. That is January 11th, 6 p.m. at 1568 Broadway at the corner of 47th Street, the Doubletree Hotel, for the Interim Pacifica National Board.
Paul, I think the importance of this announcement is that so many of the questions that people are raising on the telephone would be more properly answered if they take the time to attend this meeting, because the people who are in a position to give very definitive and specific answers will be there.
I have a feeling that room might be limited. I don't know how big a space in that hotel. I would advise people, if it's starting at 6, to get there early.
Indeed. Paul DiVincenzo, thank you. All right, we're going to move along, and once again, I'll point out to you that we have upcoming at 9:30 a guest. I hope you will be able to stay tuned for that. I want to remind you again of the editorial, the piece from the op-ed page of the editorial page of the New York Times editorial section, I suppose I should say, and also the metro section of The Times today, page B3, in Crown Heights, a case that won't go away. And part of it, James Newman, lawyer for Mr. Nelson, said yesterday that he had not spoken with prosecutors since the new trial was ordered and had no idea what they planned to do. This is a very, very difficult case to predict. There is a lot of pressure to fight this case to the end. Well, the point is, there is a case. You know, I mean, that the real center of this is that there is a case, and that whatever happened previously, folks have to move on. There is an incredible tendency, it seems to me, in recent years, of people drawn into the notion of you always have to go backward in order to make sense of your life today. Right now, what is involved in Crown Heights? And there seems to be, incidentally, reading this particular piece, and I would urge you to see it as well, page B3 of the Metro section of the Times today, there are many people speaking publicly in Crown Heights, urging everyone to see this not as a defeat or a victory, really, but to see it as part of the passage of time, and to see it as part of the functioning of our judicial system. Two men will be retried in a case that the federal judge says has to be retried. Well, either you're going to have a legal system or you're not going to have one. You know, if you're going to say the judge can't do it, it's not fair. Hey, this is what the judge said. And incidentally, you want to talk about unhappiness with the judicial system. A lot of places you can go. But the fact that we have one is really at the center of this and other matters. People want to say, throw the system out, and we hear that a lot. System doesn't work, system doesn't function. Well, systems can be corrected. We'll take some phone calls from you for a little bit. It's 9:09 in New York City. This is WBAI Pacifica Radio from New York City at 99.5 FM. Just a reminder, we are listener-supported and therefore commercial-free. We urge you to pledge to the station, and you can do that, incidentally, on our website, www.wbai.org, all lowercase. WBAI, you're on the air. Good morning.
Morning. I had a question about some of the people who were on the first Democracy Now! You were talking about yesterday. A question and a point. You mentioned Dick Gregory, and I think you referred to him as a comedian.
No, I didn't refer to him as a comedian. I quoted the document that we received here at the station, and the document described him as a comedian.
Okay. May I continue?
Yes. Well, you asked the question, didn't you?
Yes.
Didn't you want the clarification? It's not my statement that that Dick Gregory is a comedian. That's what the communique from the board said.
Okay. May I continue now?
Yes.
I read that same document. It said activist comedian.
Okay.
And he's also an appointee by the old majority that the...
Okay,
you want to call them dissidents.
Yeah, your point being what?
My point being you called him a minstrel and merely a comedian
when he's not really
been a politician.
I did not do that. And if
and
you
I
have
voted for him in 1968.
Okay, if you have the tape of that, play
it
for me now.
Say a word,
no,
you?
I'm not going to let you lie. That's what I'm not going to let you do.
What was the lie?
I'm saying I did not refer to Dick Gregory, as you just said, as, quote, a minstrel. Now, if you have a tape of that, play it for me.
Well, you used the word minstrel. That maybe I
Well,
maybe,
I will
I
say, I'll say what I said.
And I'd like to
I'll tell you what I said.
Yes.
I said, and I've said it more than once, that these meetings held by the so-called dissidents are, in my judgment, nothing more than minstrel shows. Now, where does that fall on the plane of free speech, my friend?
In other words, you were saying the Democracy Now! Program was a meeting like a minstrel show.
No, I did not say that.
No, I'm trying to understand you, seriously. What meeting?
I'm saying the meetings held by the dissidents, one of them held at the Union Hall, headed by Ray LaForest, who is, as you know, a member of the board from the lab. And I said I attended that meeting. I have attended other meetings. And I described them as being, in my view, minstrel shows.
Okay. Now, the other question I had is, I was curious about... I wanted to clarify something. Jabel Fai once told me way back in the beginning of last year, he said, you know, why are people complaining about Clayton Riley if they're supporting Bernard White? Because Bernard White really put you on BAI and backed you even when you were in trouble for committing violent acts. And
Hold it. I have committed no violent acts at this station.
Well, it's easy for you to deny it, but
you tell me when it happened. What violent act I committed.
I don't need to. People at the station.
Hey, they do not, and I'm saying this to you once again.
I am saying to you,
you are a liar. And
you
and anybody else who says that is a liar. Let me clarify before we go on to the next call. It has been a protocol at this station that anybody who commits an act of violence is subject to immediate and unequivocal dismissal. If I had struck someone as this fool who just called is suggesting, I wouldn't be here. I could not be here. And moreover, I voluntarily would have absented myself if that had happened. Have I become angry? Yes. Have I had encounters with people that were, by anyone's standard, I think, ugly? Yes. But I have not had a physical encounter that could be described as violent with anybody here. Next caller. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I was just wondering, I'm just the person just listening on the radio. I was wondering, could I hear Democracy Now! Myself and decide what the problem is?
Well, you can hear it on the streamer called WBIX. Sure, you can hear it right now, actually.
I know, but I'm just a listener who supported the station for many years, and I just wonder, you know, I hear this side that I hear endlessly on the station, but I never get to hear what their point of view is.
Well, why don't you hear them on WBIX? You'll hear their point of view.
I know, but isn't the point is we're listener supporters, and we all used to work together. At least
yeah.
That was my impression.
We all used to work together. That's true. We're a very divided station now, as you well know.
So what do you think the solution is for people who want to hear Democracy Now! On the airwaves like we used to?
Well, as you know, Democracy Now! Has been returned to the airwaves.
Not on BAI,
though. Well, that's true Monday, yesterday, and today, as far as I know. And as far as today is concerned, I have not been told whether it will be broadcast another time today. I don't know. I can't give you an answer to that.
So the thing is, as a listener, why doesn't anyone explain to us what's going on? Why don't we hear it?
Why don't you attend the meeting that begins this Friday?
Well, I live far away from
where do you live?
I live out in Connecticut.
All right. Well, do you have...
I have a child, and I'm a single mom.
I just want to know.
Do you have friends? You're the only way I know.
Do you have friends in the city who can attend the meeting?
And ask
the questions that you're asking. I don't have an answer for you, if that's
what you're
probing.
But you're the only way I'm going to know. How else will I know?
Let me repeat.
Yes.
I, as an individual, cannot give you an answer. Now, if you want to call other shows here today, maybe someone else will have an answer for
you. Could you take it upon yourself to find out so you could explain to somebody like me?
What do you want to explain? I'm not sure.
Where is democracy now that I've given money? I've given money to the station. Why don't I hear it?
Oh, wait. Okay, let me understand something.
Yeah.
So you're saying to me you only give money to the station to hear Democracy Now?
No. No, that's not what I said. I said, where is democracy now? I give money to the station. I didn't say, I'm like, why don't I know? I'm just a person on the street.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any inner, I'm not part of some big group. I don't know anything.
Okay, let me suggest then that you do this. The answer to your question, I think, will most reasonably come from management. And what
management?
I would suggest that you call 209. Please, listen, if you will. Call 209-2800. And ask to speak to the general manager.
Okay.
I think that's the best way for you to get an answer. Since you live far away and can't attend the meeting, in my judgment, that would be the best way for you to get a satisfactory answer.
But you know, the great thing about radio is that you are the mouthpiece for the community.
Personally? Is that what you're saying?
Wait, the great thing about radio is it's the mouthpiece for the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for me individually, it's inefficient.
Yeah.
For just to leave it up to me, the individual, whereas there's so much information that could be imparted now.
No, what you're saying is the only information you're interested in. You haven't mentioned a single other person, except the person who hosts. But you haven't. That's my point. You called up here to say to me, where is democracy now?
Yeah.
Okay,
why not?
Then I would ask you, are you the person who put in my mailbox yesterday a completely threatening, violent letter that began with the statement, where is democracy now? Are you that person?
No.
Okay, but you obviously have no objection to that being done. Would I be correct in that?
It's not, you know, principles over personalities. I just want to know. I'm asking you. I'm not personally attacking. I just want information. Can I ask you another thing?
Sure.
If there's a gag rule about discussing internal issues, how come you can discuss them in Mike Fader and David Rothenberg and all the
They discussed it. And incidentally, okay. See,
but you're not banned. Nobody else is banned.
I was fired. Does that help you?
For discussing the Pacifica?
Well, whatever. How about this? Where is democracy now? This is your crowd, I would assume.
I don't have a crowd.
Okay, where is democracy now?
Person.
And why is this pseudo-intellectual, arrogant, fascist prick, I guess you can say, on the air?
What?
This is what I'm reading. It's time for a few real radicals and revolutionaries left at WBAI. Listen, to kick this punk's ass. Mr. Riley, I've wanted to get a piece of you for a long time. Go ahead, issue a challenge and pledge to meet Mr. Anonymous. It is constant. I have 75 letters like this that I can show you that all begin with something about democracy now. What am I saying? You have no concern about me.
Of course I do.
No,
you're
don't.
You're a human being on the planet. You don't know me. I don't know you.
Oh.
But I'm just a person calling up and saying, how come a show that I really appreciate? I like are there other shows? I like the Pacifica Report.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I even like, what's his name, the guy with
And you're entitled to like and dislike whatever you want to.
I want to know. This is something I'm interested in.
I have given you an answer.
If you want an answer to that question... Yeah.
Call the management. They make decisions at the management level. I don't.
I'll tell you one thing, Clayton. You're the only person you can call up, talk about this issue, and you don't get banned the next day. So I give you credit for taking
goodbye.
Phone calls.
Say goodbye. Airheads enough. Okay, go on. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello?
Yeah, Clayton.
Yes.
So you're saying you don't have a problem with violence?
Yeah.
You don't have a problem with violence.
I didn't say that. I said I have not committed an act of violence.
Yeah, but an act of violence, it doesn't have to be physical. You can be intimidating. That's the same as violence, isn't it?
When you
corner somebody
and
intimidate somebody, isn't that violence? You don't have to hit anybody to be violent.
Says who?
Huh?
Says who? You?
Says me. That's right.
Well, that's just your interpretation.
If you go into the court of law, if you get somebody harassing somebody, that's violent. That's violent. You go into court of law. I don't have to hit somebody to put charges on somebody.
Okay.
And you have done this repeatedly.
Really? Give me an example.
How about with the one? Say goodbye to this guy. Oh, really?
So long. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello. WBAI, you're on the air.
I guess you were afraid about what you might be about.
No, I'm not afraid of anything, and I will tell you, if you have these continuing questions, write to the management. I want to be clear about something. I am not afraid to talk to anybody who wants to talk like a human being. Howie from the Bronx is not one of those people. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes. Hello?
Yeah. You did strike Paul D'Arienzo in the newsroom.
Not true.
Paul,
come in and clarify this. Paul is here.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. You want to clarify it with him?
Go ahead.
Okay. That did not happen, and I think Paul will tell you that it did not happen if he's about. But I'm going to say goodbye to you.
First, let me come over here, and I want to give a big hug to my man, Clayton.
Okay. Did this happen, Paul?
No, it didn't happen. Okay. Come on. This is, listen, you want to start... You know, what's funny is that the selective choosing of events is what's the most amazing thing to me because, I mean, are we going to sit here and bore the listeners with a step-by-step explanation of every argument and every
thing that ever occurred
at the station? Because,
okay, Paul, if you will, please.
I know, right? I could give you some stories
moment.
That'll turn
just,
your...
What happened then?
Just one moment. No. What happened is none of your business, first of all. Why aren't you concerned... Well, why aren't you concerned
you?
With the fact... Paul, please, just
okay,
one
sorry.
Moment. Why aren't you concerned with the fact that in an incident at the station approximately a year ago, Mimi Rosenberg consistently committed acts of violence... And no one has ever said a thing about it because Mimi Rosenberg is a, how shall I put it to you, that you will understand it. Okay? Mimi Rosenberg kicked at, grabbed a black person in this station. Not a word has ever been said about it by the dissidents because the dissidents don't care about that particular kind
I
of
I did
act.
See a statement on the Internet where Mimi signed a statement denying it, even though we have several witnesses.
Five witnesses saw it. Say goodbye to this listener, if you will. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Say goodbye. We can't.
Hello?
This connection is too, I mean, really. WBAI, you're on the air.
Peace and Islam. Good morning.
All right.
I wanted to say, you know, my wife has been listening to the station for some time now, and, you know, I see the checks come back, and, you know, I know she's sending it to the station, and I'm like, all right, cool. So I started listening. And I actually like the station. I just started listening about 3 months ago. And I actually called in on your show, Mr. Riley, the other morning.
Yes, I remember.
It's strange to me. No, it's not even strange. But I hear so many people dissenting or sort of, I read, you know, the situation as they put it on 2600 website. But I've been to a number of 2600 meetings. And don't really consider those to be not biased.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's strange how America is a country where the moral majority is supposed to rule. Now I hear all these people calling in to battle with you about what went on there, but I never hear them call in about things that are blatantly disrespectful to those as us, black people, and fight those things the way that they're fighting you.
Okay, brother, let me just interject because we're gonna have a guest in a few minutes.
Yes, sir.
And incidentally, this is a guest who will be talking about the Lemmick Nelson case. So I urge you to stay tuned.
Yes, sir.
But what people do not want to realize is that there is a very deep division at this station. It is not all about black and white. What it is about is what I would characterize as the cultural divide. People come from different places in the world culturally. And there is, whether people want to acknowledge it or not, something that I would call in its ascendancy around here, being long dormant, And that is the culture of whiteness.
Yes, sir.
Which is not necessarily about all white folks, but it is about a way of seeing the world that has frequently, around the world, imposed values on persons, countries, nations, communities of color.
You're right.
In other words, to say this is the way things are to be done. Right now, what we are confronting is a group of people who are saying, look, we are tired of black leadership. We simply don't want black people leading us. So now we're saying we have three major figures, three white women who are going to run this enterprise. And if you don't like it, we will picket your house. We will harass you on the telephone. We will put threatening letters in your mailbox because white people are going to run this enterprise by way of expanding this culture of whiteness. And I say the culture of whiteness because there are black people here who are perfectly comfortable.
Yes, sir.
In that culture. Brother, I know we're going to talk again, but I do got to scoot away now for this guest, and I urge you to stay tuned.
Keep doing what you're doing, man.
All right.
Peace.
This is WBAI. It is time for a few real radicals and revolutionaries left at WBAI to kick this punk's ass. And I am being accused. This is what I received. This is what's stuck in my mailbox, which means that somebody here on site put it in the mailbox. It wasn't mailed to me. It didn't come in an envelope with a stamp on it. It's time for a few real radicals and revolutionaries left at WBAI to kick this punk's ass. Okay? Why is this pseudo-intellectual, arrogant, fascist prick, Riley, still on the air? Okay, now people want to tell you, this brother called up, man calls up and he says, well, you don't actually have to commit an act of violence. You know, you can menace him. Well, what is this menacing enough for you? Is this the copy? Because I think I have the original, which we're going to check for fingerprints. And we'll see who's running around issuing these kinds of threats. Time for a few. Incidentally, it goes from it's time for a few radicals and revolutionaries, a few, okay, to I want to kick your ass, man. Okay. So I don't know. It's either a bunch or an individual. But when we talk about violence, how about that? And I will say to you again, 75 letters, 75 letters in my mailbox here. All of them of a threatening nature. All of them in the 75 that I saved, all of them containing the N-word. And all of them in support. I find this truly interesting. All of them in support of the program called Democracy Now! So when I referred to Amy's Army, people got in a snit. Well, if I get letters that start off praising Democracy Now! And saying, or as one letter said, Clayton Riley and Ann, like you, isn't fit to sit in the same room with Amy Goodman. I showed this to her. She laughed. She thought it was amusing. Okay, so you want to talk about who's where and why? Let's consider the whole picture. All right, now we want to get back to the Limerick Nelson, also the Charles Price case. We have a guest now coming to speak with us who was the prosecutor in the case. The case that charged Limerick Nelson with committing violence against the civil rights of Yankel Rosenbaum. Let me say now, so that we don't break during the interview, this is WBAI, Pacifica Radio in New York City. Good morning, Zachary Carter.
Good morning, Clayton. How are you?
I'm doing okay.
I've been listening.
Skating along here, you know, we're trying to stay afloat.
Okay.
Zach, we've had discussions about this case before, and one element of it that I would really like you to address as we continue this conversation is the meaning in our law system of the term violation of civil rights. That is indeed the legal element under which you prosecuted this case.
That's correct.
Talk about that, if you would.
Sure. The basis for the prosecution, which was upheld, in fact, by the United States Circuit Court for the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit of New York, was that it is unlawful under federal civil rights law for someone to interfere with the right of any citizen, of any person in this country, to the use of public facilities, including the streets, because of their race or national origin or religion. And the prosecution was brought in order to vindicate that right for everyone.
Now, many people who have expressed opinions about this have said, well, the point that seems to be overlooked by the prosecution is that Lemick Nelson was exonerated in a previous trial.
As was Rodney King by a state jury in California.
You mean the officers in the Rodney King?
That's
case.
Right. The officers in the Rodney King case were exonerated by a jury under circumstances in which most people across the country, and particularly in the African American community, were not persuaded that justice was done because it appeared that verdict was against the weight of the evidence, of the clear evidence in that case. Many people throughout New York City, and particularly within the Hasidic community, but not just exclusively in the Hasidic community, felt similarly that the civil rights of Yanko Rosenbaum had not been properly vindicated by the failed state prosecution in the unsuccessful state prosecution in that case. And that is the reason why the Justice Department undertook a full investigation of that case and ultimately determined that it was appropriate to bring a federal civil rights prosecution.
Zach, in prosecuting this case, talk about, if you will, talk about the prosecution's case in terms of what you regarded as the most persuasive evidence available to you.
Well, I think it was, there were a number of elements. There wasn't just any one particular element. There was a substantial amount of forensic evidence. Lemick Nelson was found cowering in the bushes, wearing blood stained jeans. That DNA testing established was the blood of Yanko Rosenbaum's a short distance from the scene of the stabbing. So the evidence was quite strong. I mean, he also had in his possession what it was apparently the murder weapon that was similarly tested and determined to be linked with the stabbing. And a myriad of circumstantial evidence with respect to Charles Price, his antics, were virtually not in dispute. The only issue was whether or not his conduct constituted a violation of the federal civil rights laws, and ultimately it was determined by both the district court and the jury, and ultimately the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, that it was.
Well, Zach, you used the term antics. I'm sure you know that's certainly for a radio audience a somewhat loaded term. Let's describe that as specifically as we can.
What he did was he exhorted the crowd that had gathered at the scene of the accident, the tragic accident that resulted in the death of Gavin Cato and the serious injury of his cousin. He exhorted the crowd to leave that location and to find Jews on the streets and to get the Jews, and he led the charge, and that led directly to the attack upon Yanko Rosenbaum and his death.
Let me get a timeline here, if we can do this. This all began, I think it's fair to say, with the death of 7-year-old Gavin Cato, who was struck by an automobile.
That's right.
In the vicinity of his home. And now, when I say the timeline, some reports say that instantly, immediately, there sprang up a riotous circumstance that led directly to the death of Yanko Rosenbaum. Now,
Instantly,
that's what I wanted to explore. If you would give us the timeline of events.
I haven't been focused on the on the uh, on facts of the case for some time, and in terms of reviewing the decision, there isn't that kind of focus on the timeline. But to the best of my recollection, shortly after, almost immediately after the accident, there were calls for medical assistance, and city EMS and a private ambulance service that was used by the Hasidic community at Crown Heights responded to the scene and began to treat and assist to the extent that it could be done. Gavin Cato and his cousin and the driver of the car that had been in the motorcade that was involved in the accident with that resulted in Gavin Cato's death. Because it was perceived by the crowd that the Cato children were not getting adequate attention, as it turned out, some misunderstandings about the sequence of the arrival and of EMS and the ambulance and who treated whom when, the crowd that was gathering at the accident scene, and obviously this is the kind of scene that would attract attention in any neighborhood, but particularly given under the circumstances of the nature of the motorcade and the pre-existing tensions at that time between the African American and Caribbean community on the one hand and the Hasidic community on the other, there were immediate concerns raised about whether or not these children were getting adequate attention at the scene, and real anger over the fact that the accident had happened at all. And a crowd, you know, began to gather, you know, there were shouts and exchanges and the like. Police came to the scene and responded in order to try to gain some control over the situation in the street to ensure that. That the medical personnel could do their jobs and remove people who were in need of treatment, and eventually over the course of the evening, as the crowd gathered, one of the people who arrived on the scene and who was most prominent in frankly just kind of whipping up the crowd to a frenzy was Charles Price, who was ultimately identified and indicted and convicted.
Now, did the death of Yankel Rosenbaum, I really do not recall this. Did this occur the same night?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So it was later on after the accident.
That's correct.
Had occurred. Now, what has happened now is that, in a sense, David Trager's conduct has been placed under review by the federal bench. And Trager, obviously a longtime jurist in this region, I don't know of any other instance where his decision as a jurist has been so challenged. I wonder if you talk about that.
Well, I mean, David Trager is a very, very distinguished judge of the Eastern District. He is also the former United States Attorney for that district. What has been called into question is the judgment that Judge Trager made that securing the agreement from both the prosecution and defense that two alternate jurors, one Jewish and one African American, would replace two jurors who were no longer able to continue their jury service, that once having secured that agreement, and that agreement having been racially conscious, whether or not that was legal and appropriate under existing laws governing whether or not race can be taken into account in the jury selection process. And what the Second Circuit Court of Appeals concluded, that is this three-judge panel, was that Judge Trager, while they respected his intentions in terms of trying to achieve racial diversity on the jury that would be fair to all of the parties involved, and that what he hoped would give legitimacy to any result that occurred, whether it was a conviction or an acquittal in the case, that they believed that he had crossed the line by engaging in an act of racially conscious, what they refer to as a kind of racially conscious gerrymandering of the jury. A very strong dissenting view was expressed by Judge Straub, one of the three judge panel, was that while he believed that Judge Traeger had committed an error by permitting this racial conscious decision making to occur in the jury process, that it was not an error for which the appropriate remedy was a reversal of an otherwise well-founded conviction, that is, where all the elements of the offense had been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. There was no doubt with respect to the sufficiency of the evidence. There was just a mere error in the selection in the process. Most importantly, as Judge Straub pointed out, not only did the defense not raise objection to this jury selection process, but they affirmatively and actively participated and agreed that it should happen. And Judge Straub's opinion expressed some mystification over the notion that a defendant could participate in this decision and then benefit from it not having been approved by the Court of Appeals, because generally speaking, when a defendant participates in a decision in that way or waives a right, you cannot have it both ways. You can't landmine the trial record with appellate error and then benefit from that error, because you effectively have it both ways.
Zach, where do you think the case will go from here? I should ask this question, actually. Do they have to be retried? I mean, is that absolute in this decision?
Well, at this stage, no. I mean, if there were no appeal of the of this panel's decision to reverse Judge the conviction and require a new trial, then a new trial would have to occur. But there are a number of appellate options that are available before that determination is finally made. First, the U.S. attorney could ask for rehearing from this panel, indicating that there are issues or factors that they didn't properly take into consideration. The U.S. attorney also has the option of asking the entire Second Circuit Court of Appeals rehear this decision, because it is of such a moment, it is a case of such importance, it raises legal issues of such importance that the entire Second Circuit Court of Appeals should sit in bank and hear this appeal. And then there could be a direct appeal to the United States Supreme Court.
Zach, let me ask you to wear a hat on the other side. If you were the defense attorney for Lemick Nelson or Charles Price, what would you be urging the courts to do at this point?
Well, I would assume that to the extent that the U.S. attorney tried to use any avail himself of any of those options, that those would be opposed in favor of immediate remand for a new trial.
So the defense attorneys really want the new trial. They want Lemick Nelson and Charles Price to be retried.
I would expect so.
Even with the risk that they might well be convicted again. Yeah. Zach, I want to thank you, man, for taking some time this morning. I hope as this continues, we'll have an opportunity to talk with you again.
Sure.
But, it's been a great pleasure this morning.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Zachary Carter, Zachary Carter, former, was the prosecutor in the case Lemick Nelson and Charles Price, as the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District, the area covering Brooklyn, of course. On this case, again, I want to urge you to read the piece in today's New York Times on the op-ed page 823 by Jeffrey Abramson. And it is called What Makes a Jury Fair? And he takes on some of the issues you have just heard. Now, I would like some response. We couldn't, you know, we couldn't keep Zach. He's actually, you know, a very busy attorney these days. Hopefully we'll have him back at another point. But those of you, a number of people yesterday had very strong opinions about this case. And I'd like to hear from that. Only that, however, for this remaining segment. If you do have questions or comments, and they are ones possibly that I will be able to respond to, I have had a number of conversations with Zach since this case was tried. So we'll make an effort to fill in a sense, for him to ask, to answer a few of your questions. As we reach 9:46, remember, upcoming at 9:55, Paul DiRienzo will be back with the news. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Yes. Sorry.
Oh, my gracious.
I'm sorry about that. I turned on my radio.
That's a big radio.
How you doing? How's everything going?
Well, hey, we're here, man.
I hear you. Let me just say from the back, you guys are doing a great job. I would like to hear the morning show come back, and, you know, I want to hear discussions about the war, about how Bush is acting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that he's acting in, you know, in the interest of the American people.
Okay, let me ask you to confine your remarks at this time to a response to this case, if you will.
Okay, one thing I want to find out about this case is whatever happened to the guy that murdered the child, and
well, I can give you an answer to that. The driver of the car that struck and killed Gavin Cato and also injured his cousin, Angela,
yes,
left the country and returned to his nation of Israel. And in my memory, if my memory is serving me, still lives there.
So shouldn't the police or the FBI or somebody try to go get him?
Well, actually, you may know that Reverend Al Sharpton at one point went to Israel in an attempt to engage just that aspect of it and was unsuccessful in having the man return. I don't know if that effort continues, incidentally. It may well. But to the best of my knowledge, the driver of the car still lives in Israel.
Because that sends a dangerous message to that part of the world, that they can do anything here and then run over to their country and, you know, everything will be okay.
Okay, listen, let us move on. I thank you for calling.
Okay.
WBAI, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Clayton.
Yes.
I actually was chiming in on the last caller. I was particularly struck by the whole idea of the driver. I mean, if this had been a reverse case,
mm-hmm.
you know, I just can't imagine them just letting the driver just go scot-free. And I think that the fact that the community so focused on revenge as opposed to litigation is kind of sad. It sounds like a kind of disconnectedness in terms of alternatives that are taught.
Well, I can't disagree with that, but you know, I think beginning with the fact that it was certified, and I think certified in a way that was extremely questionable, that this was an accident. You know, that was the first thing that came out about the death of Gavin Cato, that the automobile struck him, killed him, and it was an accident. There were reports that the driver had gone through a red light. There were reports that he was driving at excessive speed. But once it was set in place that it was an accident, and you are very much on point when you say the community's rising anger and desire for revenge tended to obscure what might have been very active and perhaps very successful legislation.
Yeah, and especially since there was alcohol too.
I should use not the term legislation, a legal pursuit.
Yeah,
might have been very well. Yeah, there was an intimation that alcohol might have been involved. I don't know if there was any real credible evidence of that. It may well have been true. I really can't say so.
And I understand that they were talking about the cousin or somebody related to Mr. Cato, the young Master Cato.
Gavin Cato, yeah.
Yeah, was related to him, and I'm wondering whether or not this stems from the immigrant community not being as connected and in terms of the whole litigation process. You know what I'm saying?
I do. Listen.
Know, maybe if they were more connected to the African-American community.
I see your point.
You know what I'm saying?
And it's well taken. Listen, we're going to be continuing this discussion. We're going to move along now, get a few more people in, because we just got a few
minutes
left.
Thank you. Very good.
Thank you for calling.
Sure.
WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Yes, morning, Clinton.
Good morning.
The gentleman that you had on the air, the prosecutor?
Zachary Carter.
Yeah, I think he left out one of the most important issues.
Mm-hmm.
The juror, I'm reading from the Law Journal, juror 108,
mm-hmm.
admitted that he could not have been objective.
Yes, but that was the basis on which the retrial was ordered.
Right.
The federal judge used that very specifically, juror 108, he felt was not seated appropriately. And that's really as much at the center of this decision by the federal court.
Yes, he admitted that he will be biased.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Carter conveniently didn't mention that. He only mentioned
He mentioned a lot of things, but we'll mention it. I mean, you and I can mention it, and people will still hear about it, right?
Okay. All right.
Thank you for calling.
All right.
WBAI, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, Clayton, good morning.
Good morning.
So glad I got through. You know, as I recall... I'm not from New York, by the way. Jerome from New Jersey.
Yes.
One of the things that enraged the crowd was that the father of Gavin Cato tried to assist his son. And if I'm not mistaken, the police had attempted to arrest him. The thing that precipitated the death in Yanko Rosenbaum, and again, not being from New York, only going from what I heard, was that I understand that the Lubavitch community has a citizen patrol, and Yanko Rosenbaum was a part of that patrol group, and they went out in order to disperse the crowd and jumped into a karate stand or something like that, asking the crowd commanding that the crowd move on or disperse. Mm-hmm.
All those reports were made at the time. One other thing that I think ought to be mentioned. We didn't have an opportunity to get to this with Zach at another point. We'll have a conversation, hopefully raise this with him. When Yanko Rosenbaum was taken to the hospital, he had suffered multiple wounds.
Yes.
One very serious wound, and it was questionable whether this particular wound was the most serious of them. But that wound was not treated. Apparently the doctors, in not turning him over, did not perceived that there was a wound, apparently, if memory serves me now, let me say again, in his back. Now, the reason I raise that question is that there would have been a number of questions raised in that regard, but basically they would have been non-legal questions as far as the defendants in the case were concerned, because anything at all that they did that led to the death of Yanko Rosenbaum still would have subjected them to charges. But the hospital also could have been charged with neglect, medical malpractice, any number of things.
Well, Clayton, you're absolutely right. And if I'm not mistaken, didn't the Rosenbaum family, in fact, sue the hospital? And there was a question as to, who's culpable in the death of Yanko Rosenbaum?
Well, again, you have to remember, from a strictly legal standpoint,
yes,
the wounds were delivered by the persons who were convicted of the crime.
Exactly.
Even if the hospital had been neglectful, it doesn't alter the fact that the act committed by those who were convicted led to the death.
That's
even
correct.
If the hospital was negligent.
You're
now,
correct.
What I said yesterday, incidentally, in this regard, and I hope I didn't misspeak, my intent certainly was to say, had the hospital treated that wound and had Yanko Rosenbaum survived, obviously the charges brought against both Yanko Rosenbaum and Lemick Nelson and Charles Price, were very different charges. But in fact, all of these things are particles in what has to be the continuing discussion of this case.
David Dinkins went to the hospital.
Yes, he did.
As a matter of fact, and was assured that Yanko Rosenbaum would recover.
That is indeed so. Listen, I do thank you for calling. Jerome, I know we hear from you quite often, so continue to call. It's always a pleasure to engage in conversation with you. You as well. Okay, we'll have news in just a few minutes. We'll be talking once again on events of the day, the world and the city and all that. Did I give you a number for that? For that one? I didn't.
You did.
I did. Oh, okay. All right. Just checking. Let me say again that doing wonderful and really tough service today at our board is Andrea Clark, and we thank you very much for handling those duties extremely well. Right now, his duties include letting you know what's happening in the city and the world. Here's Paul DiRienzo.
Thank you. In some cases, at least, a surrender in Afghanistan means you can go free. That's what happened in this case. In the case of the Taliban defense and justice ministers, they and other high-ranking Taliban leaders surrendered to the new Afghan government, but after recognizing the new government, they were given general amnesty and allowed to go home. Yasser Arafat insists he's sticking to a truce with Israel, but a deadly Palestinian attack on Israelis today is dealing another blow to the United States' peace efforts. Two Palestinians stormed the Israeli army post near the Gaza Strip, killing four soldiers. The attackers were then shot and killed. And police in the northern Israeli town of Nazareth are bracing for angry protests. This after Israel decided to stop construction of a mosque next to a major Christian shrine. The construction had caused friction between Christians and Muslims in the town that was the boyhood home of Jesus. Thomas Junta is expected to tell his side of the story at his manslaughter trial today in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Yesterday, jurors heard from his 12-year-old son. He described the fight between his dad and the father of another young hockey player after an argument over rough play. Prosecutors in Moscow, Russia, are investigating the alleged theft from Russia's largest company, the Gazprom natural gas monopoly. They've detained three top executives from its Siber petrochemical subsidiary on charges of abusing authority. Siber's chief executive and chairman were detained. The action follows President Vladimir Putin's call for Gazprom to examine how its assets are managed. Gazprom, which owns a majority stake in Siber, has asked prosecutors to investigate allegations of $85 million in illegal sales through its affiliates. Prosecutors raided the Moscow headquarters of Siber, a giant company in its own right, on Tuesday. Siber would not comment on the prosecutor's action. Gazprom controls one-third of the world's gas reserves and meets a quarter of the European Union's gas demand. But its stock is worth only $8 billion, largely because of its murky finances. Media reports have charged that Gazprom's previous management used shadowy companies to shift assets and cash to their families and friends. A recently fired nuclear plant worker was arrested for allegedly threatening plant employees, and about 150 weapons were found in a shed he rented and in his home. That's according to authorities. The man was fired from his job at the San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station in North San Diego County, California, in recent weeks. The plant, 65 miles south of Los Angeles, is owned by Southern California Edison. Officials served a search warrant on a storage shed in San Juan Capistrano, rented by the man early Wednesday, that's today. They found about 150 weapons along with thousands of rounds of ammunition in the storage unit and at his home. Two sheriff's deputies were overcome by fumes at the shed from an unknown chemical. Authorities described the chemical as a yellow vapor from an ammunition canister. The deputies were taken to a hospital to be examined, and a hazardous materials team was sent to the site. Russell said a friend of the suspect contacted authorities earlier this week and told them the man had threatened plant employees. The nature of the threat was not immediately released. A top United States senator says the United States should consider attacking Iraq and ousting Saddam Hussein after it's done in Afghanistan. That's what John McCain said today while visiting the USS Theodore Roosevelt aircraft carrier in the Arabian Sea. At one point, McCain yelled out, "Next up, Baghdad." McCain says Iraq presents a clear and present danger to the United States. He's touring the region with several other senators, including Joseph Lieberman. Lieberman says the war against terrorism will not end for many Americans until chief terrorist suspect Osama bin Laden has been killed or captured. And in local news, Yonkers police are looking for two men who are believed responsible for the shooting death of Amy Guzman 1 week before her second birthday. The girl was killed Monday evening when a bullet came through her wall while she was watching TV in her Yonkers apartment. Her father, Julio Guzman, ran into the street outside his Elm Street home, cradling his daughter in his arms. Two police officers rushed the wounded toddler and her parents to St. Joseph's Medical Center. The girl was transferred to the Westchester Medical Center, where she died. Amy had been sitting in her parents' bedroom at 166 Elm Street about 3:30 p.m. Monday, watching a Winnie the Pooh cartoon video.